Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hello, hello, Internet. This is Kimberly Chow, one of the directors of Food Book Fair and a co-host of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, a radio show on Heritage Radio Network, where we talk about what we're reading, watching, and listening to with friends and fam in and around the world of food, in and about food media and elsewhere. And I'm really hyped today to be on the show with our very special guests, Kimberly M. Jenkins and Yadan Israel. We'll be chopping it up about culture, intersections, representations, all sorts of good stuff. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's hey, good to be here.
We lit. This is dope. I mean, people can't see it, but you can see people eating. This is dope.
Yeah, so we're coming to you live right now in the back of Roberta's in beautiful, sunny Bushwick, Brooklyn today. So if you are in the neighborhood and you see us behind that big glass window in the recycled shipping container in the back of a pizza restaurant, you can come knock and say hi for the next 40 minutes or so. But, you know, if you can see us, it's a little dark. Glass is a little dark. But we're going to get into what y'all are working on. It sounds like you have some really hot new projects. Some things going on tonight, some stuff that just launched yesterday, some new media, some new content and content to come. But just want to start, as we always start on the show, talking about what is on your nightstand or what you're reading or watching or listening to. Mostly these, since the last 2 days, I've just been playing Kendrick and Rihanna's Loyalty video on repeat.
Yeah, yeah.
And using that as like a visual and wardrobe inspiration, as well as like mental state inspiration. But what are you guys into?
Kim, you want to?
I am pulling it up on my phone right now because I don't want to screw up the title.
Okay.
I have in my room at my desk The Birth of Cool: Style Narratives of the African Diaspora by scholar Carol Tulloch.
Oh, that sounds dope.
It's dope. And I also have a really dense, big book, Fashion Theory, A Reader, edited by Malcolm Barnard, and a book on cultural studies by Professor Susan Kaiser, who teaches fashion studies, which is the field I work in, out in California. So those are a couple of the books that I have around.
There's a lot of books. I'm getting a lot of books. Book I brought with me is Rakesh Satyal's No One Can Pronounce My Name, like this novel about like performance and identity. And how identities rupture when they're not fully your own. Another book that hasn't even come out yet, comes out this Tuesday, dope book called You Can Play the Girl. It's by Karina Chocano. It's a critical collection of essays about the ways in which women are made to play the supporting role in their own lives.
Wow.
Based on the expectations that Hollywood sets. So she started off, she's a film critic, and she brings that. She has this opening where she talks about having a daughter who she used to try to make watch. She liked princess movies, and she tried to give her Alice in Wonderland, and her daughter rejected that. But it's because Alice in Wonderland is not a princess. She's a real girl, so she's trying to fit into Wonderland. But she uses Wonderland as a metaphor for the ways in which women are always either in and out of step with the realities that they're in. And so that becomes the overarching theme of what happens when you are made to play the supporting role in your own life.
Wow.
And all these essays around that. So that book is dope. The Art of Death by Edwige Dondekat. It's a collection from Grey Wolf, Edwige Dondekat. Part of how she's coping with her mother's death is by reading how other writers bring language to what it means to lose and stuff like that. So I could go on all day. So I'll just leave those three on the table for now.
Wow. I got to add all of those to my list.
They dope books. They dope books.
Yadan and Food Book Fair met when we collaborated on a Food Book Fair 2017 event, a salon, a round table inspired by No Name in the Street, James Baldwin's book, with our very, very special guest, Dr. Jessica B. Harris, a past host of a Heritage Radio Network show here as well, a true goddess, culinary expert, great author.
Yeah.
And we were talking there about food, self-care, and the body, and what the importance of food in James Baldwin's life, and the importance of it in his writing, but also in how it sort of inspired his life through the people that he was breaking bread with. And it also includes one of the flyest, I think, cover photos I've ever seen.
Definitely.
My Soul Looks Back is, we've talked about this a lot on the show, actually, because different people, my co-host Amanda and then other guests would be reading the book, and then they'd be like, oh my God, I'm reading this book. It's amazing. But great cover. Dr. J looking amazing in a very in beautiful, this beautiful outfit and headscarf and big 70s glasses. So I know something we have a lot in common is how we all love clothing. And that's how Kim and I met.
Yes.
At One of a Fine, this great vintage store in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn. And but we actually met, really, really met, across the street eating lunch.
At R&D Foods.
At R&D Foods, sitting next to each other. While she was on break. And I think some teenage street-style photographers were trying to take her picture.
It was called Brooklyn. It's a Tumblr called Brooklyn Beauties.
Cool. did you end up on the blog?
Oh, yeah. Shortly. She's like, you'll be on here. She was so professional, this kid. And she was like, you'll be on in one or two weeks. And there I was.
Cool. Can you tell us more about your work in... It's not just the fashion space. And it's not just academia.
Yeah, and just the slipperiness of it all is what excites me. Trying to make a long story short, this is kind of a career that I just cobbled together and just kind of created for myself. I'm from Texas, and I moved to New York to enroll in a master's program called Fashion Studies at Parsons School of Design, and I did that in 2011, and I was in the second ever cohort, so we were total guinea pigs with this, because it's this new field about thinking about fashion as an object and a phenomenon. Why do we wear what we wear? What are all the different intersections that often goes unconsidered? So I moved out here. It was a two-year program, loved it, and was lucky enough to get a job as a professor upon graduation. So I started at Pratt Institute. Also, that was in fall of 2013, and also Parsons School of Design, pretty much at the same damn time. So I was very lucky in that regard. So the classes I started taking on and putting together introduce undergrad students at Parsons and Pratt to thinking critically about fashion. It's not just about Project Runway. It's about constructing and navigating your gender, racial identity. It's about politics. It's about sustainability. It's psychological. There's just so many intersections there. So I've been doing that for 4 years now. And this year I've really been kind of peeking through what I do. Like, I've really been just kind of trying to see in what new creative ways I can explore what I do beyond being a professor. So I've been wanting to engage with the public audience and bring these crucial conversations to the public more. So a colleague and friend of mine, Jonathan Michael Square, who's going to be teaching history courses at Harvard this fall, he's going to be teaching about the Black experience through dress. Mm-hmm. He and I joined forces and put together a workshop that we had at Parsons July 15th called Fashion and Justice. And it was specifically about how can clothing be a tool to navigate racial identity, to seek justice, as a form of resistance. In what ways can that be considered? It went quite well. It was sold out, and we made a lot of great friends and connections through it. People encouraged us to create it into a series, just kind of take it on the road. So that's what we're doing now. So I'm trying to see what other collaborative things I can do with this and these conversations, because I'm finding that it's pretty valuable to people outside of academia. Cool. So I don't want to keep these conversations just between, like, in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I want to see where else I can take it. So, yeah, it's just, like, coming out in myriad ways. One last thing. I just won a research grant or award through the New School. It's the Innovation and Education Fund, where basically I proposed creating a digital platform for the New School that presents a repository of all of the things that are kind of left out in design history, fashion history. It's really kind of a labor of love that I'm trying to deliver to all the students of color, the professors of color, where when they're trying to go to the library and do research and they're not finding themselves in it or what they need, I want to build this kind of digital platform that has all of those sort of overlooked or hidden stories or important bits of research for them. So
damn, girl.
I like how you just like under, cause like, yeah, I got this grant. Like, yeah, I think, yeah.
I just wrote it, just dumping out all this information. I was just typing passionately, like at midnight, writing to them. And I was like, I'm not going to get this. It just seems like it was like borderline angry. Just like really like, there's a deficit here. Like, we need this information. And then all of a sudden I got like this letter, like, thank you for your submission. This is awesome. You won.
Well, I think that shows that there's a hunger for it, not just in you and in people that could benefit from it, but the school and the foundation as well. It's like,
it behooves, like, I think we're like people, we had a place where it behooves people to like pay attention to what's not there, and especially pay people who they don't want to do the work. So it's like, oh, you already are feeling a need that we didn't even know we had. Yeah, take it.
Yeah,
do what you need to do. I've learned to like do that less, like the thing of like kind of counting myself out, of assuming like people didn't want the thing that I didn't think that. I think using other people's no as an excuse to not give myself a yes. Like I'm learning how to do that less.
Yeah.
Like let me hear no from their mouths. Like, and less about that and more of like, if I'm looking for somebody else to tell me yes, that means I haven't told myself yes yet. And learning how to like self-validate, like, nah, this is important. I don't care if y'all funded or not. This is going to get done. So I'm not even asking like for help. I'm telling y'all, this is what I'm doing.
Yes.
Do y'all, you know, get on, but the like the bandwagon, right? You know, it's going to pull out the station with or without you. So it's like, are you on?
Train's leaving the station.
Yeah.
You just got to be brave and motivate.
Yeah.
And just do it.
Exactly. I mean,
because who else is going to do it?
I think, yeah. And I think the more I've come to that, the more I've like also just been like on some like, even if everyone says no, like, I got the most important yes. It's for me. Like, I said yes to me. So we gonna make it work.
That's a good way to tee us up to talk about what you're working on now. We're going to take a real quick commercial break, though, and then we're going to come back with you, Don Israel.
Yeah, I got commercials.
We got a little commercial. We got to keep the lights on. And Kim Jenkins. This Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit radio network producing shows and hosting shows like this one, Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, as well as many covering everything from craft brewing, food politics, inside school food, urban gardening, all across the internet, all across time. So go to heritageradionetwork.org to support, become a member today, and keep us on the air. We'll talk to you in a bit.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market believes in seeking out local, fresh, and seasonal food, and in supporting local farmers, makers, and the community as a whole, economically and agriculturally. Whole Foods Market believes in food that is vivid and colorful, fresh and full of nutrients. Food that connects you to your body, the seasons, and to nature. Food that helps you do more, sleep better, and wake up happier. Found in over 400 locations throughout the United States, Whole Foods Market only sells food that meets their standards, which means no artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or sweeteners, ever. Whole Foods Market believes in real food. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more.
Hello, Airwaves. We're back. This is Kimberly Chow with Food Book Fair on Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair, our show about what we're reading, watching, and listening to with our friends and family in and around the food world and beyond. Really lucky today to be on air with Professor Kimberly M. Jenkins, a professor of fashion and history at Pratt and Parsons, who's doing many a good thing, wearing many hats. Especially, we were just chopping it up about her workshop on food and fashion and justice, but food and justice is important too. We're increasingly realizing those things are intractable and things are intersectional, and some folks have known that and have been talking about it for a minute. But I think a lot more folks are all reckoning with that now and reconciling, and clearly there's a hunger for that kind of knowledge and those kind of classes, so it's exciting to hear about what you've been doing. We'll get into more of that as well. But we were just talking about no's versus yeses and validating yourself for yourself with Yadon Israel, who is the founder of Literary Swag Book Club and just started a new media project.
Yeah.
Because another thing we've been talking about in general and more broadly is representation in fashion, in literature, and also how folks and how subjects are represented. And this is a pretty dope way. I think people are being represented actually visually. So would love for you to tell us about it.
Thank you. So like Lit is like a weekly conversation interview series. It's like literally everything like Hot 97, Breakfast Club, Morning Show, Sway in the Morning, that those shows are for like specifically for like literaries, writers, people with books, people who love books, to talk about that. I think I grew up Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and I remember like when I first, you know, what I would say is like I was taught, my father was a musician, so the first language I learned was hip hop. Like I knew how to, he taught me how to rap as like young as 2-3 years old. So music and hip hop culture was more immediate to me than everything. Like that was how, that was my like vehicle for information. So everything I do, I approach it through the lens of hip hop. Like, how can I make this hip hop? So I came to literature as a industry, as a world pretty late. So I was looking, and the aesthetics of it was just like, nah, this ain't, I don't belong here. Like, even though I have the skill and the talent and whatever, and I could converse at that level with people. You see how I said converse instead of conversate, right? So like, I know how to do that, but it was like, I don't want to do this here, because it was like at first when you want to fit in, you don't care about the ways in which sticking out makes you naturally capable of changing something that needs to be changed. You just want to like cut off all the things and remove all the things that make you, that marks your body as different. But mm-hmm. when you're in the literary world, you can't help but to see, like, it's like you can count on hand how many people of color in a room. Then you can count on a on like literally like I don't even think like on hands, but on a hand, excuse me, how many people who look like you are actually like you, right? Mm. So like the disheartening thing is when you think you like, oh, that's a black person, I'm gonna go talk to him, and then you talk to them, you're like, damn man, you not what I'm from. So it's like you a little bit more like it's a little bit more disheartening to see that. And then I saw like in these like these practices in the literary world that are very implicit, because I think that all systems of power, when you're really working with power and not privilege, it's implicit. You don't have to state that like you don't want somebody here. You just have so many practices that have been practiced that tell people you don't belong. So I don't have to put a sign up anymore. You just know not to go in there, because when have you ever seen somebody that look like you or act like you or be like you in there?
So the system is a well-oiled machine.
Yeah. So when you
the
start...
The system's working exactly like they designed it to.
It works on its own.
And so, and what that system does, right, like is what, like James Baldwin said, is like oppression is what... is oppression, it gets you to think about yourself in a way that's, you know, just against you. It gets you to think against yourself. And so being in a literary world, like there were things that were very common sense to me that I wasn't acting on because I was like, I can't do that here. And that was also because I was like, once again, like looking for people's permission. Like you want the like the gatekeepers to open the gates for you. But then it's like, well, do I even want to be like in this? Like the, you know, the historical conversation, the conundrum, do you want to integrate into a burning building? Like, nah, like at first I did, because it's like, well, everyone else is burning. And it's like, nah, like these are people that are burning in this building. I didn't grow up with these people. I don't like, I talk to them. I have less in common with them. The more I talk to them, the more I see I don't fit in. But I'm not going to do the thing of I'm not going to leave, because then that's like, because I also do belong here, but I got to figure out the way that I showed how I belong here. And I think that that's why, like, you know, literary swag came about, was like, it was visual. The first thing that went up was a picture of a young black boy reading To Kill a Mockingbird. And he was like, you know, swagged out. And I always tell the story like,
yeah, you saw him on the train.
Right? Yeah. The A train or whatever. But it was a black boy that like started this whole movement. Right. Like, but in addition to the fact that a black dude like is the one that's the major proponent of it. But it was like that to me was important. Like it was the visual of having a black kid represented. And that's not something literature was for me. Like literature was never something. That's why like kids who read was like, oh, you're trying to be white, because it was like we never seen someone sort of. Not read, but champion reading, who was black. Like, we didn't grow up in the 60s and 70s where, like, you know, Elvis Cleavers and James Baldwin's and Angela Davis's was the standard. Like, we grew up with the main language, the main vehicle for information was hip-hop. And it's like, if you could not communicate your language in that way, then it was like, or something akin to that, then it was like, what are you doing? And that's what I had to come, that's the reference point I had to find. Like, how do I make that reference point relevant in the world that doesn't appreciate that standpoint, and not just on the page, right? Because one of the first things that let me know that this fight to fit into this world was going to be bigger than writing on the page is when I realized that a lot of people that I write for can't read. Like, honestly, like, I remember being in, like, you know, situations where I would try to read my, have people read my work, and they'd be like, nah, I'm not reading that, sure, to get out my face. And I took that on the chin, and then I was like, fuck that, I'm just going to start, excuse me, I don't know if I curse, but.
You can curse.
No, but I was gonna I was like, forget that. I'm just going, like, I'm gonna read it to people. And I read it and people like, yo, I like that or whatever. And what's funny was people by ear could tell me like that sentence is all fix that. So these were people in my neighborhood, my first editors. And they somebody pulled me to the side and was like, the reason why I told you that I didn't want to read is because I can't. And he, you know, when that person told me that, I was like, oh, like that's
shit.
Yeah, like it's, you know, for everything that said, like the comparison I've been running with literature, like in the arts, you have like the music, the movies, the photographies, the visual artists, the fashion designers. Those are like, if those were sports, those are sexy sports, right? Those are like your basketballs, your footballs, your baseballs, command high salaries, a lot of FaceTime. Writing is like the golf. Right, like you, one, it's like something you can't, a poor kid cannot get good at golf. poor kids are good at, like amazing at soccer. They are amazing at basketball because you don't, it's a low entry point. A lot mm-hmm. of people can enter. With golf, you need a golf club. You need a course. You need to have access. With literature, it's the same thing. You need time to literally just sit down and read.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you need time to be able to work on a sentence. You need time to be able to figure out what a sentence is doing. And when you're poor, or American poor especially, mm-hmm. like, you don't have time in those ways because it's like time placed here is time being lost there, time being lost with family, time being lost with friends. And so the type of person writers typically are by virtue of what they're doing is they're people who are solid, you know, they're mm-hmm. solitary. And when you grow up in a community and you have a reference point in hip hop that's so communal, it's like, how do you reconcile mm-hmm. the communal with the solitary? Mm-hmm. How do I make the solitary even worth it? Because even when you look at the way writers, I mean, like fashion designers produce, musicians produce, they're always in a concert of people. Like
mm-hmm. it's all about collaboration. Yeah,
down to the end yeah. of the wire. And like with writing, it's like two or three people, four people. And I was like, this is not the medium I work in. Mm-hmm. And so this show, like Lit, what it really is about, how do I show literally the community of writers? Mm-hmm. Like when you look at these books, you don't see faces a lot. Mm-hmm. And to me, I think it's a way of like suggesting a diversity that does not really exist, because it's like if you go into a Strand bookstore, and I love Strand, you go into like Barnes & Noble, you go into any bookstore, you look at the book covers, all the book covers suggest like there's different types of people and books. Then you start flipping to the back, which was something that mattered to me, because I was a person who like I would buy albums off of the album cover. Like the out, like 50 Cent's Get Rich or Die Trying is like, that's art to me, right? Like, you know, Ready to Die, like the album cover with the baby on the front with the afro says as much to me mm-hmm. as the music did, because that was the way you listen to the music. And so when I'm looking at these book covers, it's like, I'm not learning nothing about the person mm-hmm. that I'm supposed to be reading about. And so for me, Lit, the show is like, we've never had a Howard Stern, American Bandstand, a TRL, like a 106 in Park for writers. There's never been in the history of literature something specifically for writers that even if you're not a writer, you have to come through the lens of writing, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, you know what? I'm gonna just do it. Like, and when you see that, I've had enough conversations where I've like pitched versions of this to people, and it's always been this thing like, I don't know how this is gonna work, right? And it's that thing like you were saying, Kim, yeah. about you know, like being worried that this is messy. And it's like, well, the biggest part of this mess is that this wasn't done in a long time. So mm-hmm. like, I'm at this place where it's like, I'm a little bit over the permission, because it's like the people I'm asking for permission from is like, if you would have done this, I wouldn't even have to do it. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I do it, it's like someone, like you live in a house with a bunch of people, no one does the dishes. And then like, you got to do the dishes. I don't want help at this point. Cause if you was going to help, you would have been help with dishes. So like, I'm at that place now where I'll just do the dishes, because like the dishes need to be done.
These analogies, like home sports, are really good.
Well, at the essence, like this is hip-hop and writing, yep. as you like, and hip-hop is all mm-hmm. analogous language. So like, that's what the show is. And I realized that, like, you know, I remember being in an MFA program arguing with writers about this, and they're like, Yadon, writing is never going to be as big as music because it's not the same. And I'm like, but you're taking for granted how music and how sports became sports. Like before the Michael Jordan era of basketball, and before like what's his name, David Stern came into the league, basketball players had second jobs. Like people were not getting endorsement deals that allowed them to eat before they even mm-hmm. touched on the court. There were people who were visionaries that said, how do we make this a universal language? Right? Music was something like only like rich people had access to instruments in most cases. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's like the assumption that where things are is where they always were is like a refusal to reckon with what history really brings of fashion, mm-hmm. all these things. Mm-hmm. And when you really look at the history, you go, no, these things are created. And it comes from somebody who sees that this has more potential than what people are using it as. So that's what the show is. It's just every Monday's on YouTube. And the first guest is like Tracy O'Neill, but we have like Ashley Ford on the show. We have like Mahogany Brown. We have John Murillo. And these are names that like I say them and people are like, who? But that's the point. Like,
I
don't want a who. I want, oh, I know that person. Because in other worlds, you know, I don't have to explain who Jay-Z is. Jay-Z is like, he's a noun and an adjective, right? Like you say Beyonce and it's like, that's a verb. Like,
yeah.
You know, like these things, how they work in language, mm-hmm. like I don't have to explain. And the fact that we have to do so much explanation for what writing is, mm-hmm. I don't like that. So I got to figure that's what this show is answering.
That's your work?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure, Kim, you can hear and see and certainly have similar experiences in these parallel worlds, mm-hmm. parallel, very white worlds of literature and fashion. Yeah. Shout out that this is an all POC studio today.
Yes. So when the Adam was talking about, gosh, which part? There was just so much I was digesting. It was really great. Just creating these spaces, because no one else is going to create it for you. That was really the impetus for my colleague Jonathan Square and I when we created Fashion and Justice, for two reasons, actually. The system in which we work in academia and the dialogue and topics that are just kind of circulating in our fields of fashion studies, history, and fashion history. We created Fashion and Justice, the workshop is this day-long workshop, and my mentor graciously sponsored a room for us, so it helped add legitimacy to have us in Parsons, and also just to talk about all the things that no one else was really going to talk about. Like, who else was going to do it? Who was going to talk about fashion and race and just kind of put it on blast and kind of deliver this perspective that he and I were uniquely qualified to do? Because there's workshops on, like, race and identity, but we are uniquely qualified to talk about fashion and race, where I'm coming in as a professor who teaches about this. I teach about everyone's history, and I can teach about, like, fashion and race. So, like, regularly I teach, like, Western fashion history. Yeah. So we wanted to kind of break the mold there and have these sort of uncomfortable conversations, but with rigor. This was about providing solutions and kind of breaking it down and creating a framework for our topic. And so that was our first thing, was to talk about fashion and race with our academic perspective and help develop the field that we work in. And also the other thing, when it comes to labor, intellectual labor, it's no secret that, like, in academia, oftentimes we, you know, might be underpaid, or we're always asked to go come in and do something for free, like, frequently. And we, in the fashion industry, also just is, like, capitalizes on free labor of internships and things for, quote unquote, visibility or for your resume. And so,
as does the literary world, the publishing world.
I think all the art world.
So to be industrious, where Jonathan and I were like, no, fuck this. Like, we're going to have a workshop. We're going to charge tickets, and we're going to pay ourselves, and we're going to pay. We're going to bring on a couple of guests who we believe in, and we want to give them visibility, and we're going to pay them too. How about that? And we're just, you know, not going to wait around for these opportunities to swing around. We're just creating them for ourselves, and we want to do more with that because no one else is going to pay us for this. No one else is going to value this. I brought in, just for instance, that day, I invited one of my former students, Joy Douglas, who was in my fashion and race class and just graduated with this amazing collection called Rebranded. And it's this collaborative project she did where she wants to explore how people who are incarcerated are exploring their post-incarceration identity. And she created this fashion collection about
deep.
That. It was so great. And so I brought her on, and she's like, me? You want me to come? I was like, yes, you. And I'm going to pay you too, because you're just, like, always doing stuff, like, for free. And we're going to stop that right here, because it's fashion injustice. So it's just kind of kicking the door open and just, like, making these opportunities, just going in and just doing these things off our own back.
And you know that that is probably so energizing for her, if not now immediately, but in the future when she becomes in a position like yours to say, like, you know, I'm going to uplift and support someone else.
And not to sound so, like, capitalistic, like it's all about money, but adds mobility, and it instills a sense of pride sometimes too. And it's like, look, you came in here. This is your time, Joy. Yeah. You know, here's this.
But that's, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, but I was going to say a thing about money, like, you know, and I think every artist is in that, like, uncomfortable place where, like, because we love what we do, we feel guilty bringing money into the picture. Mm-hmm. But then you get to a place where it's like, well, like, why can't you do your art a lot of times? Because you don't have money. And what is the first thing people don't want to give you when they say they value your art? They don't want to give you money. Mm-hmm. And they're telling you they want to give you a platform, but they're making money. And it's like, you know, I'm learning how to literally, even as a poor person, like American poor, I'm going to keep saying that, how to deconstruct that notion that, like, I don't need money to do what I do because it's all money. Mm-hmm. And it's not saying that money is the only thing, but for me, like, I've even gotten out of the place of having to, like, make the disclaimer that, oh, I'm not money hungry, because it's like, no, like, why do I have to make that claim when it's like, a lot of times poor artists are the ones putting out the most, mm-hmm. in terms of, like, we don't have those resources where, you know, especially as a person of color, like, you make a mistake, you don't have those resources that allows you to bounce back. You got to spend a lot of time and money trying to fix a mistake that if you had a little bit over what I've just learned, runway capital, I didn't even know what the hell that was. And it's money that allows you to just kind of exist between places.
It's the impolite conversation no one wants to have.
Right.
But it's those barriers, those crucial barriers that keep people of color back, you know, because when there's people who have this hookup or this connection or this sponsorship, and you're wondering, like, how did they get on and I didn't, you know?
And they, and they hide it behind the language. Mm-hmm. It's hard work.
Yeah.
There's a great, speaking of books, there's a great book by Manjula Martin called Scratch.
Mm.
And it's like a confession. Like, she got a lot of these writers to write about literally how the economics of writing works, how writers don't get. She made this site called Who Pays Writers. And it's a site that literally writers go on, and you can, like, look at all these sites that pay, like from, like, you know, the Gawker, or it used to be Gawker, but, like, the Guardians to Atlantic's, and they'll show you how much they pay, like, the average, how much they pay per word, how frequently they pay. Because all those invisible mechanisms are what guide the hand of how literaries, you know, how art people do their job. Mm-hmm. And when there's so much of the myth and romanticism fronted, and when you ask real questions at, you know, panels and stuff, there's few people who are going to pull the curtain back and be like, this is not what you think it is. Because part of how you get that free labor is allowing people to believe that is bigger than what it is. Like, oh, no, you should just want to work for a big fashion brand.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you want to get paid? Your payment is being able to say you worked for a big fashion brand. It's like, nah.
Just like in fashion. I mean, a lot of these people who are doing, like, working at these magazines or brands, working these jobs that most people couldn't survive on, it's because they can afford to just do this. They know someone and they already have the income or the family income to do this and just kind of enjoy this, like The Hills, you know. People follow the stream of the fashion because they watch The Hills on MTV and just think, no, they're not paying anybody.
And what do most people who look like who can afford to work for free?
Right.
White people.
Not like POCs.
I'm becoming more nuanced in my understanding of whiteness to just say, like, it's a lump and whole white people by and large, but it's like the majority of it is white, and then it's a particular type of white person who have access to power and things. And then what's interesting is, like, I've learned, like, even the language of, like, of power. Like, people in power don't like to be made aware that they have power. So it's like, oh, I don't have money, my parents have money. Oh, I'm comfortable, I'm not rich. And it's like, wow, like, okay, well, you know, you living real comfortable in Soho right now, taking an unpaid internship that allows you to get steps further into a career that is, like, I've never taken an unpaid internship simply because, one, I value my work, and two, I can't afford to not get paid. I can't afford to put valuable work out into the world and then be told that, you know, someday this will pan out.
Right.
And so it's just like those things have even kept me, quote unquote, back from certain opportunities, quote unquote, because it's like, I probably could have been working at, like, one of these bigger companies if I would have took an unpaid internship. But it was like, I'm not going to do that because it's like, how am I paying my phone bill? How am I paying for transportation? How am I paying for food? How am I paying for rent? Like, these are questions that some people take for granted. And so that all gets collapsed under, like, the very, like, insidious phrase of hard work. Because it's like, oh, I just worked harder than you. Like, no, there are so many other things you didn't have to worry about that allowed you to focus on a particular type of work.
Right.
Like, your only job is to show up and do that job. My job is to figure out how I'm going to get there, how I'm going to eat, how I'm going to do all these things and do the job. And then when you don't have those other things, it's easy to believe that, like, you know, being at, you know, at the eighth peg and jumping up two levels means you worked harder than somebody that was at like zero or three and they had to jump up seven levels to get to your level,
right,
or whatever.
Like, I'm all for the conversation of like following your dream. Like, that's what I did. I took a big risk coming here from Texas to do what I want to do. But yeah, that's exactly, oftentimes when we talk about just follow your dream and, you know, everything will just fall into place. But there's this intersectional dialogue that needs to happen about just how many more humps, hoops you and I have to jump through, mm-hmm. though. Like, we can still do it, but it's just like, people don't realize like the hoops we have to jump through.
You were starting at peg one or three,
yeah,
instead of eight.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that that's like, I have a good friend now who, like, we became friends. His name is Jess Rise, like a white novelist. And he had came to an MFA program and he had gave some advice to MFAs, like
my face and yours.
Yeah. Your face and mine. Yeah.
Your face and mine.
Riverhead. And he was like, just write the weirdest things you can write. Don't worry about publishing and don't worry about like the economics. Just write what you want to write. And I like raised my hand and I was like, nah, son, like we're not about to get here. You're not about to lie to people and tell them just write what they want to write, because the market is a real thing. And I think when you're somebody who, like, as a black writer, black male writer, and I'm even in workshop, we're not even talking about money, and I'm watching essays get turned into ethnographies because the room doesn't look like or come from the experience, I'm being asked to explain more things than I'm asked to write things. I'm like, I'm not asking you to write about your, like, you know, trip to Cabo. Like, I don't understand. I didn't know summer was a verb, but I'm not about to ask you to break that down. I'm like, oh, you know, it's the assumption I'm supposed to know what you know. But mm-hmm. on the other end, you're not supposed to know what I know. And how that ends up affecting my work is, like, I always have to think about how do I make this read? Mm-hmm. How do I make this accessible? Which I think is why people of color tend to make better art, because we're more considerate and compassionate for an audience. Like, we actually know that our work is going to have to interact with the world at some point. Whereas, like, what I saw across the board with, like, a lot of the white writers in comparison was, like, they didn't have to care about that.
Right.
And not say they didn't have to care. They didn't care. Because the truth is that we all have to do that work. The mm-hmm. problem with it is when some people are made to do work that other people can't. So, like, it's like, even with women, like, you're supposed to do the work, in theory, of making sure you don't get raped. But as a man, I'm not supposed to do the work of, like, leaving you the fuck alone. Mm-hmm. Right. But it's like that work, everyone has to do the work of dismantling an insidious power structure. And when certain people are only asked to do it, it's assumed that those people are responsible for the power structure.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, oh, no, you have to solve a problem that you didn't create. And it's like, no, I don't. And that's been difficult of navigating, even like where I am, is like, how do I answer the questions that I'm interested in answering?
Mm-hmm.
How do I not fall for answering your questions? Because even mm-hmm. as a black writer, I'm pretty sure when you're the only one in the field, you answer so many white people's questions and you think you're answering your own. And then you mm-hmm. kind of pull back and you're like, I didn't even get to talk about what I wanted to talk about today.
Yeah.
And it's that additional intellectual and sometimes emotional labor that we have to take on.
Emotional labor.
I need to not only know about myself and my own history, I got to know yours too. And that's what I do on a regular, a weekly basis at Parsons and Pratt. I need to teach fashion history and fashion with a capital F and Western, you know, in parentheses, you know, and then I could talk about fashion and race. But first, I need to know all their history first.
Right.
I need to talk about Dior and Yves Saint Laurent and all. I got to know my Charles Worth. I need to know all of that before I can even bring up Anne Lowe, who no one else needs to know about.
Right.
They're like, who's Anne Lowe? So it's
you want to spend a couple seconds talking about Anne Lowe so everyone gets...
Put them on.
Put Anne Lowe
between
on.
Elizabeth Keckley and Anne Lowe. Elizabeth Keckley, I guess going in like chronological order, was a dressmaker, black woman dressmaker in the 19th century, who designed clothes for Abraham Lincoln's wife.
Wow.
And then Anne Lowe was working in the mid century in the U.S. Dressing debutantes, socialites. She designed Jacqueline Kennedy's dress. She enjoyed a great deal of success, but at the expense of really just knowing how to navigate these all white spaces and just dress these women and just kind of put them first.
Mm.
I'll never forget. Jacqueline Kennedy was asked, "Who made your wedding dress?" And she said, "Oh, a colored woman." And this and Lo had been kind of involved in their family for years, dressing them as they grew up.
Right.
And then to use that critical platform to like actually put her name out there, she didn't do it.
Right.
And so it's that kind of stuff. And the, so the intellectual labor, just bring it back to another book, actually. My colleague Minha Pham, who teaches at Pratt Institute, she published a book 2 years ago entitled Asians Wear Clothes on the Internet. And it's about the raced and gendered labor involved in style blogging. Mm-hmm. And she uses as her primary case studies Susanna Lau, mm-hmm. and Brian Boy. And how white fashion, really the industry, kind of poach ideas from them, appropriate ideas from them, like Brian Boy having his poses kind of stolen. You know, and they don't get the credit.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. just the labor involved in looking polished, refined, with it,
yeah.
knowledgeable, all the extra labor they have to do in kind of managing their Asian identity for a predominantly white, fashionable audience.
Mm.
Do you want to remain palatable for a white audience, or do you want to resist it? So it's like all those things. And I really want to I've kind of made it a mission to talk more about this intellectual labor as I'm exploring how to become a little bit louder in my work on fashion and race, letting it be known about intellectual labor and what we have to take on and the emotional labor that I have to do. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say about that.
I will note to folks who can't see us in the back of Roberta's, Kim is wearing an enamel pin that says unapologetic.
I've power been fist. Unapologetic ever since. It's like a talisman.
Yeah. You got that from yes. your friends at Nylon, right?
February, I was featured in Nylon for their Unapologetic series. Sydney Gore, who recently left Nylon, she reached out to me and wanted to do a piece. She was doing just these profiles on women of color who she finds to be kind of unapologetic about what they do. She asked me to be featured, and so she wrote about me. And as a thank you, she sent me this little tiny pink enamel pin with a black fist clenched. And it, above it, it says, unapologetic, and funds from raised in selling these pins went directly to Black Lives Matter. And so I found, it's kind of crazy, when you think about like clothing and adornment and how you kind of embody mm-hmm. these things and how powerful they can be, ever since I've been wearing this pin, I have just been increasingly unapologetic. So it's worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really dig how also seeing you the last 5 or 6 months rocking this pin, you will wear with any kind of outfit. That
it will fit.
Yes.
You make
because
it.
Unapologetic you make it, goes yeah. with everything.
Yeah.
So... To sort of distill some of this conversation that we've been having and about operating in the spaces that you have been and realizing the need coming from the outside as well as within yourself to start making work for you,
right?
And making work for the people that you really want to make work for, uh-huh. whatever that means. Was there any kind of And this has been interesting because as I've become more radicalized in this way in my life, I keep meeting other people that are coming to the same kind of realization and reconciling and figuring out how to do that. Was there any kind of unlocking, any kind of moment, or was it a accumulation of realizing what was outside and saying, oh shit, I got to do this for myself because nobody else is going to?
I think a lot of it came from being honest about what I already had. I think the American cultural mindset is to always talk about what you don't have.
Mm.
It's to always put yourself against, like that's the narrative, from nothing to something. So you have to, in order to feel like you've made it in this country, you have to put yourself in a place where you did not have anything. And I think that's why it's crucial, like even people who come from privilege have to tell themselves they did not have what they had, because how else do you become an American besides starting from nothing and moving to something? I think a lot of why I'm able to claim the space I had is because I'm not moving. I don't tell myself that. Like, I've ceased telling myself the lie that I came from nothing. Like, which is why I even came out earlier and said that my father was a musician who taught mm-hmm. me how to rap, because I wasn't saying that before. Before, I was the kid whose father left at 10. I didn't talk about those 10 years that he was there and what he gave me in those 10 years, right? Like, I don't. Mm. You talk about growing up poor But I don't talk about, no, I grew up Section 8 welfare. When you look at other countries, you still had things. These are not the things you necessarily want in comparison to somebody with a yacht, somebody blah, blah, blah. But it's like you had what you had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think excavating those real things that you have, it lets you know what you're capable of bringing, of what you're capable of having access to.
Mm.
And so I think a lot of my disillusionment with the world came in with a real reckoning of who I really am, which is like, I think that's something that's at the crux of the American identity. I think so many people are afraid of who they really are that they like disavow. And we tell ourselves, we erase our backgrounds so we can be like these blank canvases for people to paint on. And some people are fine with that. But I think that I was betraying myself when I went into the world thinking I had to do it on someone else's terms, because that was never me. That was never genuine to me. So that's why, like, you know, as much as I talk about like the infrastructure of whiteness, what I also am using accountability for. Is like, but you want it to be a part of that whiteness. You want what whiteness gives you in these certain ways. And so if you want the things that whiteness has, then you have to be honest about why you want these things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want these things, are these things you need or these things you want? And I think once I started to change that word, that little verb from need to want, I didn't want it anymore, because it's like, it's not that serious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if, you know, I never win as a writer a National Book Award or a Pulitzer or any of these awards that make you a real literary, it's like, well, I didn't grow up caring about that stuff, right? Like, so, like, why? Like, I grew up caring about who, like, what music was making, like, the girls dance at the block party. Like, I wanted to create that experience. So, like, to get into a place where now I don't care about what I always cared about because I feel like I gotta care about something else, I betrayed myself first.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's the first betrayal ever, is like, you lie to yourself, and then everyone else just, you know, I feel like the world tells you the truth and you lie to yourself about what the world tells you. And so no matter what you're seeing, you're telling yourself, well, you know, even when you know you take a bad deal and your stomach is churning in the beginning of it, you're still trying to figure out, well, maybe this is not going to turn out the way it ends up turning out. And then you go, well, why did I make that choice? And then it was, I want them to like me. I want them to tell me yes. And I think that that comes from self-esteem, and that comes from, and that's why, like, living in a country that gets you to think, or a culture that gets you to think against yourself is dangerous, because it's like, you're not trusting yourself. You're trusting someone else with your life.
Mm-hmm.
Who doesn't have your life and like your best your best interest at heart. And so, like, for me, like, that's how I shifted. It was just like, I have to get back to what's always been there. My mother's been a community activist her whole life. She was throwing barbecues with her, like, food stamps, feeding the families on the block, and we barely have food, but that's what I come from. So it's like, what am I talking about? Like
Mm-hmm.
That's what I have to, you know. So, you know, Literary Swag Book Club is literally what I see. My mother used to hold conversations in her living room, in our living room, with people from the neighborhood would come around and stuff like that. And so it's like, that's what I have to tap into, is the things that I've always seen growing up. Not try to go like, I never had this, so now we need that, or black people never had, and black, like, pathologizing the black experience. It's like, even with literature, I told myself I would have read more if there was more black books. When you take one black history course, it's too many goddamn books. And it's like, God. So it's like, what I have to be more honest with is like, well, I didn't have access to them, which is a whole nother set of.
It's a whole nother.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but, I was going to say, but this is a whole nother set of things, is when you talk about wanting or aspiring or being or desiring what are seen as white things. They're seen as things that are marked by whiteness, like success, privilege, nice things, because of the power system that exists and how we are made to feel that that's what we want.
Yeah.
But anyway,
and just everything Yadon is saying is just very black. Like, it's just very, like, just soul food. I was thinking of making do, like, how in hindsight you're realizing we didn't have this, but we had this, and we made something rich out of it.
Right.
And so for, like, your show, it's like, well, we may not have much right now, but look what we made out of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's like soul food, you know,
that's, it's just exactly,
like,
what it is.
And bringing it back to food.
Yeah.
Also, it's just taking what you've got and just making something out of it,
right.
Making a way out of no way.
Mm-hmm.
And two takeaways I got from you is just audacity and intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Just like,
I think that's what creates, like, I think the most brilliant, like, art is, like I said, like, just trusting yourself. Like, you know, what's so beautiful about, like, watching, like, all these documentaries that's coming out, like the Diddy documentary and the Defiant Ones and, like, Jay-Z's 444 footnotes and stuff like that. It's just seeing, like, how much doubt exists in people you didn't think have doubt, because when things are presented to the world,
yep,
they were presented as certainties. Like, oh, like this was the blueprint. You know, you have these million-dollar vehicles behind saying this is the number one album, blah blah blah. And then you peel that layer back, and you find out that Ice Cube actually balled up, you know, fucked the police and threw it in the garbage, and it was his friend
who
like reached into the garbage and got it out for him. So it's like, what happens in those moments where like, we just assume that the things that just exist in this world exist because people wanted them there, as opposed to like, everyone had to fight to be here. And that to me is like why I've even stopped calling like white privilege a privilege, because it's like the, you know, sort of the indignant, because I think the most indicative thing of whiteness is this indignance that white people face when an injustice finally hits their doorstep. Like, they don't know how to react to it. So there's this very like, what? How could this happen? Blah, blah, blah. Who's your, and it's like, the why fragility. Are you so angry? But it's like, you've never actually had to deal with that feeling before. So the first time you feel it, or when you do feel it, something immediately happens, as opposed to like, I know as women of color, there's so many slights that happen that if you really sat there and dealt with every slight, it would break you. So it's like, you have to figure out like, okay, I have to figure out to cope with this. Even like black man, I have to like figure out to cope with these things, because there's so many things that happen that sly, and only you notice them sometimes. And it's like, okay, I can't afford to always lose my shit. So I'm developing a certain, that's why like people of color are so cool to like whiteness. Like, oh, you're so like, you're so composed and you're so held together. And it's like, I can't unravel. I can't afford to unravel in the system. But I think like, you know, with whiteness, there's an easy unraveling because there's not that much bandage. Right? Like, there's not that many scars and wounds. And if they are scars and wounds, there's scars and wounds that have, like, you know, white people by and large have been taught that aren't, that those aren't real. Like, you know, like white, you know, I've had rich friends talk to me about being rich. Like, there's nothing, like, my life is boring. Tell me about your life. And I'm like, no, what, tell me about your life. And then they talk about their lives. I'm like, your life kind of sounds more fucked up than mine. Like, but they're not taught to think about their lives the way that people of color, like, we're taught to pathologize our lives immediately. Tell us about everything you didn't have, and tell us the how you started here but ended up there. Well, whereas, like, you know, the narrative. Yeah. Tell us, give us the narrative. Yeah. And it's like, I want that narrative from you. Oh, well, no, I grew up, you know, like, no, but how you grew up? Then you find out people's parents, like, divorce is very natural, and, like, around a lot of my friends who have of privilege, like, divorce is like a very normal thing for them. Whereas, like, damn, like, that seems like that rupture didn't bother you. And then you start interrogating more than you allow yourself to be questioned. And when I started doing that, like, interrogating whiteness as opposed to just accepting it as like a part of life, I'm like, no, why is that there? Then you start seeing like the fragility and the fracturing of everything. And so it's just like, oh, you don't even know as much as I thought you knew. And I was part of this power was me giving it to you. And now I'm at a place where I don't give power that ain't earned. Like, you got to prove to me that you deserve what I'm about to give you. And if you
don't, we're so strong and we bear so much on our back.
Yeah.
And we have to be so, like, we just have to have this dexterity to kind of navigate all this. But in people, oftentimes, that's the coolness. They can't see that we're managing all that internally and still looking great on the outside. Boom. They can't tell. And they want some of that. And so, like, what you're saying, they treat us like this utility. I want some of that. Let me, you know, just tap into some more of that. Give me more of that.
Yeah.
You know, reveal some of this
without thinking about the price you pay for that, right? Yeah. Like, to wear this, like, I got these red bottoms on and these, like, this Comme des Garçons shirt on. I'm in credit debt looking like this, and these Tom Ford
looking fly in spite of,
right? Exactly. And but people are looking like, you wouldn't, well, if you're in debt, why would you buy that? It's like, that's part of why I'm in debt, because part of how I get to navigate rooms and not get stopped at the door of certain institutions where they go, do you belong here? They go, oh, yeah, you look like you fit. I, like, 9 times out of 10 at a literary event, I'm the best dressed person there. But part of why I have to be the best dressed person is because a lot of times when you're not that person, they treat you like you don't belong in that room. And so, like, you know, I don't get stopped and asked what I'm doing here. I always get confused for some other black writer. Most of which I don't look nothing like, but the assumption is that I want something. Like, I'm, it's like, you would only dress up like this if you, like, celebrated something. And, like, I realized, like, you know, every day is a celebration.
They're like, what's the occasion?
Yeah, like, just Tuesday is the celebration. Like, that's what we're dealing with. And so that's helped me, you know, I think, like I said, accepting what our culture is and, like, not using it, casting it against a culture that took it from us. But, like, nah, like, even with everything that's been taken, there are things that's always going to be ours.
I wish I could keep talking to both of you all afternoon, but we got to wrap it up. I have so many other questions, so much more conversation that we can give.
You might need another episode.
Part two. We're going to have you come back for our next season starting the fall. And continue this. And I hope we continue this outside of the booth. We got some pizza to eat, so hopefully that can happen. But
thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for both being here. And I really wanted to get you both in a room. So I'm glad about that. But first, I want to say, if you could give the folks listening some homework, some things to read, some continuation of this conversation in case they're not in a room eating pizza with us later or before our next episode together. And also how they can continue following what you do across social media on the internet. Let them know. You want to start?
I'll let you take it.
How can we find you?
Yes. You can find me, Kimberly M as in Michelle, Jenkins.com. Same for my Instagram. I'm at Kimberly M Jenkins.com. You can follow all my work, and I'm gearing up for the fall semester, which I'm excited about, and I'm hosting a talk series at Pratt called Fashion Talks, so look out for me, or I'll be posting photos and information on all of that. A couple of quick books, I guess. I would say, this Carol Tulloch book, The Birth of Cool, Style Narratives of the African Diaspora. I would also recommend Professor Tanisha C. Ford. She published a book 2 years ago called Liberated Threads. It's about Black women post-civil rights era, how they use dress, adornment, hair to sort of liberate themselves and navigate politics. Also, as I mentioned earlier, Minha Pham's book, Asians Wear Clothes on the Internet, if you're interested in Asian bloggers and her analysis of her critical analysis of Asian bloggers.
Damn. It's a good list.
Y'all can follow me at Yadon, Yahdon, on the gram. On Twitter, it's Yadon Israel. The same first name, last name like the country. Follow Lit Platform at Lit Platform on all the channels. That's where all the episodes will be. If you definitely want to come out to a conversation about books, which is sometimes more interesting than the book itself, come to the Literary Swag Book Club. Every last Thursday at 150 Nevins in Brooklyn, New York. Dope clothing store. And the book we were meeting this month is Jade Chang's The Wangs Versus the World, which is a novel about this father who runs a cosmetic company that tanks during the 2008 recession. But it's really a book about like a father who has to lose everything he thinks he needs before he realizes what he actually has, which is his family. Mm. And it's like what we've been talking about is like when you remove those things that you think you need and you see like, oh, the thing you were actually doing was always there. And so, Literary Swag Book Club, August 31st, 7 p.m.
It really is the most lit book club.
Oh, yeah. Kim was there.
I've been there.
Yeah,
Can't wait to come back.
All right.
Well, thank you so much. I'm Kimberly Chow. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. We've been on air with Kim Jenkins and Yadon Israel, and we'll talk to you real soon. Thanks.
Hey.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended Reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.